This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Kevin Zeis, president of Common Sense for Drug Policy, about new models for drug policy reform in the United States. And we'll talk with Chicago attorney Matt Pierce about a recent court victory involving a 1992 federal anti-terrorism statute. We'll hear a powerful speech from activist Clark Kissinger at the Brecht Forum in New York. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've had a number of guests examine drug policies and the connection to prison populations in the United States. Today, we talk with Kevin Zeis. Kevin is a National Lawyers Guild member. He ran for the U.S. Senate position in Maryland and is currently the president of Common Sense for Drug Policy. Kevin also writes for the newsletter Counterpunch and has been published in the Washington Post, Common Dreams, and Alternet.
Welcome, Kevin, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, on Law and Disorder, over the past few years, we've covered drug laws a bit and prison issues and the relationship between the two. And clearly, there's a very close relationship. Can you talk briefly about the work that you've done in this area and what you see as the sort of the largest concerns for our society?
Well, I've worked in this area for more than 25 years, and so it's a kind of a long-term view. And I got involved after I was in law school back in late 1970s. And basically what's evolved over that time period has been a major change in how law enforcement operates in our society, the powers it has, and the impact it has on our culture. The prison culture has become a major force politically and has become a major impact on various cultures, especially poor and minority communities. I think it's important to put in context where the United States is compared to the rest of the world when it comes to these kinds of issues. We have about 25% of the world's prison population. One out of four of the world's prisoners reside in the land of the free, compared to 5% of the world's population. So we have a disproportionate prison population. And when you look into that prison population, what you see is a black and brown dominated prison population. When you look beyond that, at every step of the criminal justice process, you see discretion by police, by judges, by probation officers, by parole officers, all having a racially disproportionate impact, unfair to people with...
So the numbers are really extraordinary, because if you're talking, you have 5-1, you know, more out of the population of the world than we should, and if you factor in black and Latino, it's probably just gigantic, I mean, in terms of the discrimination.
It's absolutely gigantic in terms of discrimination, and it's also had an impact on our politics. We can't look at either political party, the two dominant parties, Democrat or Republican, and not see support for this intensive drug war and increasing power for law enforcement, meaning increasing power for the executive branch, because that's where law enforcement comes out of. And so the political impact, for example, in California, the largest political action committee in the state is the Prison Guard Union.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't know that. You mean the PAC that gives the most money to candidates
exactly.
is prison guards?
Exactly. You can see it in Gray Davis's tenure. He was California governor. He became very unpopular and was forced out of office for a lot of reasons, but it was He grew the prison population in California dramatically. You can see it in the impact in New York with the Rockefeller drug laws. Look at the impact of those upstate politicians where those prisons are being built and prison employees are based. They pretty much blocked real progress on the Rockefeller drug laws.
Kevin, is the ostensible reason that they want more jobs in their communities?
Well, that's what they say, is the, you know, and we have created our economy in the United States has gotten weaker and weaker, and the middle class is shrinking and poverty is increasing, so there is a lot of pressure. And so these crummy, really crummy jobs in corrections are seen as a great gift. There finally are now becoming some studies are coming out finally looking at the impact of prisons in communities and rural communities and whether it's a positive impact on the economy or not. And it's much less of a positive than people thought. The people who come to visit prisons don't have a lot of money to spend, so secondary businesses like hotels and restaurants don't get the impact that they expect. The prison guard salaries are not great, and they aren't great jobs as far as enriching people's lives go. And so they're seeing that there's much less of a positive effect than they expected.
Let me ask you something. You know, the problem you describe and the problem, the horrible situation here about prisons and prisoners, is really clear. What kind of remedies do we think of? Are you thinking about? What's it? I mean, I understand the lobbying, you know, the prison guards and our political parties and how difficult this is. But I know that part of it is involved in drugs. Part of it is maybe the nature of the country. I don't really know where you begin to try and get into this issue.
Well, it is a challenging thing. And what the good news is that there are alternatives that work. We can see around the world and even around the country, we can see pieces of policies that actually do work. I live in Baltimore, Maryland, for example, which is a city that, as those who watch The Wire know on HBO, are plagued by drug crime and drug violence and a multi-generational, probably in our third or fourth generation now, of heroin addiction. And, you know, we keep doing the same thing over and over again and get the same results, which is, you know, more degradation in the community, more crime, more violence, and more addiction. And, you know, the good news is, as I said, there are some solutions that are starting to show themselves and around the world, particularly on issues like heroin. You know, about 10 years ago, Switzerland, which is a country that very much had the same kind of a policy toward drugs as we did, a very drug war-oriented policy, moved toward a model of harm reduction, to reduce the harms, take a public health approach. And they started out trying, well, something that got bad publicity was Needle Park, which was really just a free-for-all in a park that was kind of a peninsula that was isolated, no services, nothing really developed, just let the people do what they want. And that didn't work. A laissez-faire approach didn't work. But then they moved toward, rather than going back toward the drug war, they moved toward a harm reduction model, and they put in place treatment on request. That's something you can do in the United States with not much controversy. People who want treatment should get it. That has a big positive impact on reducing crime and reducing addiction. You take one addict off the street, that addict usually supplies their habit by crime or by selling drugs or by prostitution. You take that addict off the street, you reduce that. That wasn't enough. So then they made methadone widely available, easily available methadone, no bureaucracy, no red tape. The United States is a very bureaucratic system with methadone. It's almost impossible. It's a big hassle. Even though it works very well, it's very hard to get to people. They went to a low threshold methadone, and that helped a great deal. We could also do that in the United States. But the third thing they did, which I think is the most important we start to try, is allowing people to go to a clinic, purchase their heroin there, and use their heroin there. And I said purchase. It's not given away. It's purchased, but for a legal price rather than an illegal price, which is about 10 times more than the legal price, so about 5 francs versus 500 francs.
Wait, so which is more if you...
The illegal price is, let's say, 500 francs. The legal price is like 5 francs.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you buy it for 5 francs, which means a lot less robbing, stealing, prostitution, drug sales to make 5 francs a day rather than 500. And a person gets their heroin, uses it at the clinic. What did they find? They found dramatic reductions in crime. I'm talking over 50% reduction.
Wow,
in crime.
Wow, that's amazing to me.
They found a 30% reduction in homelessness. They found
unbelievable.
Like a 16% increase in employment. And these are all World Health Organization figures. These are independent research. And so what's happened since they did that, in Switzerland they take approach of referendums, and that was a pilot project. And so then the country voted on whether we want to continue this or not. And, you know, Switzerland's a pretty puritanical country in many ways, and they have a strong religious belief system there. But they voted 2-1 in favor of keeping the program and expanding it. So now it's become the program nationwide. And what you're seeing also now is Germany, Holland, Australia, all taking this model and applying it in their countries. We need to start to try that here. A pilot project in a city like Baltimore or San Francisco, cities with high drug use rates, try it and see if it works. If it works, it reduces crime, violence, homelessness, and joblessness. What an improvement. And also what it does, it reduces, there's no spread of HIV. Right now, the major source of HIV is injecting drug use. There's no increase in distribution. In fact, there's a decrease because you're taking hardcore users off the street. You don't have to sell drugs to make up their habit. And so you're reducing distribution. And there's no deaths, no overdose deaths. And we've seen overdose deaths in the United States going up pretty consistently for the last 20 years.
And you've sold us. But I want to ask this question. This country, it strikes me, is in the dilemma we're in because we are so puritanical and legislators are afraid that if they advocate for sensible reform policies, they're going to be seen as soft on crime. Why can't we start implementing pilot programs like that?
I think you laid it out. I mean, you know, President Clinton checkmated the Republicans on the drug issue by putting a general in charge of drug policy, General Barry McCaffrey, who was the head of the Southern Command, and he put in a police chief.
The czar.
As a drug czar rather than a health leader.
When I think about even medical marijuana and the fact that the federal government went after its use in California so heavily, the idea that you can do this, let's say, I mean, I was thinking like a place like Baltimore, could you ever get them on their own to do it? And then it would be illegal, right? Because the federal government makes it illegal to sell drugs, right?
That's right. Back when Kurt Schmoke was mayor of Baltimore and I served on his working group, one of the things he was advocating was a needle exchange program. And this is when needle exchange was just getting started. It took several years of lobbying the state to allow needle exchange to happen in Baltimore. Now it is happening and it is the policy. It can be done, and I think it can be sold very much as an effective smart crime approach. I get the sense that we are in a potential moment of sea change. And even though Obama and Hillary and Edwards have records of corporate Democrats, their rhetoric is changing to a much more populist, effective government rhetoric. And I think people are coming out and voting because of that rhetoric, not looking at their records, which is really not consistent with the rhetoric.
The only good part of the record is that didn't Obama, what did he take, cocaine or something?
Oh, yeah, he has a history of drug use when he was in high school, college age kid. And so that makes me nervous that he'll have to prove he's tough on drugs.
That's true. That is a problem the other way. Right.
But he does have the experience, at least. No one's really talked about Hillary's drug use, whether she was smoking marijuana when she was going to school. Who knows? But
right.
I think we are at a time, though, when the population is ready for effective government, and we've seen the failure of mandatory sentencing. All Democratic candidates are talking about reforming mandatory sentencing. They're all talking about no raids on medical marijuana clubs, so they are saying the right things.
Yeah.
Whether they'll do the right things is another question, but I do think we're energizing the population, and that is the key to it all. We need to get the public up calling for this, and when we do that, then we'll see some change happen. But it's going to take the public. You can't expect a white knight political leader on the white horse to come save us.
Kevin, speaking of presidents' policies on drug use, wasn't Richard Nixon actually quite enlightened in terms of pouring more money into treatment programs?
What happened with Nixon was very interesting. I wouldn't say he was enlightened. The war on drugs phrase came from him running for office in 1968. So that language was his. And then when he got elected, he had to actually come up with a way to reduce crime. And so he brought in some experts on heroin addiction, and they recommended methadone. And so he became the methadone president. He really funded methadone at a high level. But at the same time, he also appointed a commission called the Schaefer Commission, the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, named after Raymond Schaefer, the governor of Pennsylvania, who, by the way, was chosen to be head of that commission because when he was governor, he said that if you look at the sun when you're taking LSD, you'll go blind. So he came in as a very unenlightened chairman. By the end of taking testimony around the country for a couple of years, his commission came with a report that recommended the decriminalization of marijuana so that possession was not a crime and that non-profit transfers of marijuana was not a crime. And he also recommended a public health approach to hard drugs. Now, Nixon immediately rejected that commission. And, in fact, they increased marijuana arrests by 100,000 in 1 year, the year after the commission recommended that marijuana possession be essentially legalized. What's interesting about that is at the same time that we had that commission, the Dutch had a very similar commission that reached the same conclusions. The difference was the Dutch followed the advice of their experts, unlike Nixon, who rejected it. And the result, 30 years later, 40 years later, Holland has one half the marijuana use rate per capita, one third the heroin use rate, and one quarter the cocaine use rate. And so they've had a much more effective approach with lower HIV, lower prison population, lower expenses, and less drug use. And so I think we need to go back and actually look at what these folks said, because they made recommendations that were right on the target. And it's about time the United States start to really put forward a pragmatic solution, a problem-solving solution, an effective government solution, rather than political rhetoric that's not going to solve the problem.
Kevin, if our listeners want to get involved in this issue, get active, what do you suggest? Are there websites? I know you're involved in so many of these major organizations doing this, but where would you send them?
There are a number of great websites. I would start, the organization I'm president of is Common Sense for Drug Policy, and the initials are the website, CSDP, commonsensedrugpolicy.org, CSDP.org. They want to get the facts on this question. The best source that has a website called Drug War Facts. It's put up on my organization. Drugwarfacts.org is a great place to start. If you want to get involved in the local level, a group that can really provide you web services and connect you with people and get you started that way is DrugSense, drugsense.org. And from those groups, you can get into a whole range of groups. There are groups out there that are law enforcement people, treatment people, broad drug policy, like Drug Policy Alliance, based in New York and Washington. You know, there's a number of groups that are doing great work, and there really is a movement out there people can get involved with and make a big difference.
We really appreciate this, and I know you've been at it for a long time, but I do sense in what you're speaking some optimism about going forward, so I really appreciate that.
Well, I think we're at a time in our public on a number of issues. I work on other issues like stopping the war and our changing our policy from a militarist foreign policy to a more diplomatic-based foreign policy, and our democracy movement's going well with efforts to get paper trails for voting machines. And so I think the population is waking up, and I really do believe that we are overdue for a generation of positive, progressive reform, and I think the drug issue is just one part of that.
Well, it's great to have you on, and great to hear about your work, Kevin. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Federal appeals court in Chicago recently tossed out a multi-million dollar judgment awarded to the family of an American teenager killed in a 1996 terrorist attack in the West Bank. The Boehm family brought the suit under a 1992 federal anti-terrorism law, allowing U.S. citizens to sue for civil damages. The court found that lawyers for the Boehm family failed to present credible evidence that Hamas was responsible for the attack. We talk now with Chicago-based attorney Matt Pierce about this victory. Matt is with the firm Hughes, Sokol, Pierce, Resnick, and Dim Limited. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Matt.
Thank you very much.
Matt, you've won a major victory given the attempt by the Bush administration to really close down almost everything Muslim. Can you put the victory into context for our listeners?
Yeah, I like to look at the Seventh Circuit opinion in the Boehm case as a real victory for the rule of law. As I know the three of you in your work have experienced in the past now endlessly long 6 years almost that we've been going through in the post-9/11 era, one of the most frightening aspects is the way the basic legal protections and principles that we all took for granted seem to evaporate. This was a horrible case in which a tragedy in the Middle East was transformed in a most inappropriate manner into an effort to cripple all of the Palestinian rights activists in the United States. And it was a sort of a bizarre terrorism-related wrongful death lawsuit. And in the post-9/11 era of incredible emotionalism and fear, a magistrate judge who ended up with this case ended up striking all of the evidence, because there was none, that these activists had been responsible for this death in Israel in 1995, and then proceeded to apply that same evidence that he had stricken to enter a massive judgment, for most of the defendants, a summary judgment of liability for the death, resulting in a troubled award of $52 million troubled to $156 million. The United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit heard argument on this case in an extraordinarily long hearing for over 2 years ago. It was an argument that lasted a good 2.5 hours in front of the Court of Appeals, and so we've been sort of waiting eagerly now for a two-year time period. The opinion that came down is a resounding victory for the rule of law, because it says, in spite of the tragedy that underlies this case, the rules of evidence have to be applied, the rules of tort liability have to be applied, and simply the invocation of the word terrorism and the manipulation of what is admittedly a tragedy that occurred to the son of this family that brought suit is insufficient to, under our system of laws, to find people liable for the consequences of that act. So we're incredibly gratified. We're particularly gratified, frankly, in the context of this case. And the author, the senior jurist on this panel, who is an outstanding judge, is a first-generation Jewish refugee.
Who's that?
Ilana Rovner is her name.
Wow.
You know, it's particularly significant that a courageous, honest Jewish judge says in so many words, "I'm a judge."
Now, yeah. Matt, just so our listeners are clear on this, what happened recently was that the court found that there was no clear evidence showing the defendant's activities directly contributed to the fatal attack.
That's right. The court found there was no proof of actual causation. That is, simply there was no proof that their conduct was a cause, in plain English. You know, lawyers play with these permutations of causation, but actual causation is what normal people think of as causation. Did you play a role in making something happen? And the court said there was no evidence that such a role had been played.
And who were the three defendants or groups of defendants that were on the line here?
I represent a United States citizen of Palestinian birth named Mohammed Salah, who has been subjected to an almost endless stream of legal misproceedings of a variety of sorts, this being only one of many. But in addition, the defendants included the Holy Land Fund, which was, until the government crippled it, the largest Muslim charity in the United States. A group of Muslim activists that are and organizations that are lumped together under the title American Muslim Society, but it's really more than one organization, as well as a scholarly institution here in the Chicago area called the Quranic Literacy Institute, which has as its sole mission the translation of the Quran into contemporary English. That is, there are many English language translations of the Quran, but they tend to be, you know, sort of in a formalized and British-oriented English, and for the increasingly large and growing American Muslim population, the QLI's mission was to write a version of the Islamic Bible that would be accessible to people who spoke American English, if you will. Those are the defendants, including some related organizations. In addition, there were defendants who were Hamas members in the Middle East, that is, who were not physically in the United States. And as to those defendants, there were defaults entered and or dismissals. One of them died. They sued the estate. That didn't successfully happen. Another one's in prison in the Palestinian National Authority prison system. And another one, I think, is in Syria at this point. And those are people who are acknowledged, admitted members of Hamas, although as to them as well, the court found, even though they weren't on appeal, there's no evidence that they caused it either. Indeed, the court found there's no evidence that Hamas caused this murder.
Because what you're saying, we should tell our audience that this case was brought under a law from 1992 that allows victims of terrorism to seek civil damages against the groups that may be deemed responsible for such acts.
Absolutely correct.
And have we seen more of these cases being brought since the events of 2001?
There has been a significant increase in these cases. They have mostly floundered in the courts. They have, of course, in the bringing of them, an incredibly coercive effect. They silence people. They are often brought, as this one was, by plaintiffs that have outside funding. lead lawyer in this lawsuit is the general counsel of the American Israel Public Action Committee, Nate Lewin. These cases tend to be a spare no expense litigation, the goal of which seems to be as much to cripple the defendants by the burden of litigation as it is to achieve any kind of legally cognizable victory.
And I totally agree with you. It's precisely what I think they're trying to do. And here they took on the greatest Muslim charity in the United States, which is trying under really difficult circumstances to alleviate the situation, particularly in Gaza. I know Mohammed Salah, who we've featured on this program several times, and we've interviewed Michael Deutsch. Salah was imprisoned in Israel, then they tried to imprison him here, and in fact, he's now in prison again.
That's correct.
They really took him out of the picture. Here was somebody just trying to get money. You got to understand, there people in Gaza, children who are brain damaged from lack of nutrition, and that kind of charitable effort is what the bad guys here went after and tried to stop.
Yeah, the conditions in the so-called occupied territories are, or Palestine, if you wish, are horrific. It is a matter of huge international concern, both among progressives and enlightened people around the world, and certainly among Muslims around the world, that there is a real human rights violation taking place on the ground every day in the Middle East. And there are, and have been, as there are with immigrant groups all over the world, all the time, lots of efforts on the part of people in happier, more peaceful, and more prosperous parts of the world, including the United States, to send money home to help their families and friends. And Salah's so-called crime was that he was asked to bring money to families in the occupied territories who had lost their husbands and sons when, in an act of political retribution, the Israeli government deported and imprisoned 1,500 young Palestinian men in response to the kidnapping and killing of an Israeli border guard. That was way back in the early 1990s. He spent time in Israeli military prison. Thereafter, 5 years, he was released. He came back to the United States. He was been designated a specially designated terrorist while he was in jail with no notice or hearing by executive order of President Clinton. All of his assets have been blocked. He tried desperately to put his life back together. He recently faced a criminal trial in which our office, as well as People's Law Office, represented him. Mike Deutsch, who you mentioned, was lead trial counsel. Incredibly, in that case as well, an American jury rejected the terrorism charges against Salah. Now, once again, the American legal system has, in the case of Muhammad and in the case of QLI and in the case of HLF, issued, you know, it's the kind of thing that makes me happy that I do what I do for a living, that is, that I'm a lawyer. It really kind of gives me confidence that there are some brave people calling it straight within the legal system. The Court of Appeals has said here, as far as they're concerned, this isn't about Hamas, this isn't about Israel, this isn't, in a sense, even about David Boyne. It's about submitting controversies to a rule of law and applying the laws in a fair manner. And here we had a law that said that people could bring civil damages suits if they were injured by acts of international terrorism. And what the court said, in so many words, is there is no evidence that these people injured anybody.
What's the next step? I understand the case is being sent back to the U.S. District Court.
Well, before that, we will be getting a motion for reconsideration and rehearing en banc. We've already received a granted motion for extension of time to file that. I have no doubt that such a motion will be filed. I frankly would be a little surprised, given the level of funding of the plaintiffs in this case, that they wouldn't try a cert petition to the Supreme Court as well. I don't think either of those have much of a chance of succeeding. The two jurists who joined in the majority opinion of the court here are both incredibly well-respected. Diane Wood was, before she went on the bench, one of the most brilliant law professors in the history of the University of Chicago Law School. Alana Rovner was a former federal prosecutor, then a district court judge, and longtime member of the Court of Appeals here. And as I mentioned as well, you know, she is also probably one of the best respected Jewish federal appeals judges in the United States.
I hope you're right, but I have a searing memory of what happened in the case of the Cuban Five.
There's no guarantees. You're right. You're right. But I'm cautiously optimistic about this one. We will then go back down to the district court, and the Seventh Circuit has ordered that the case be assigned to a new judge.
And we'll have you back on the program to announce yet another victory.
Well, we think that we will get this case now dismissed at the trial court level because the lack of evidence that existed the last time hasn't been cured by the passage of time.
That's great, Matt. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your interest and all your good work.
Thanks,
good work.
Matt.
Thanks
bye
for your
bye.
Good work. So long.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
We'll be right back.
go now to hear a speech from activist Clark Kissinger. He was among the speakers at the Brecht Forum that discussed the near completion, since 9/11, of the infrastructure for a police state in the United States, including its legal and ideological apparatus. Let's have a listen.
Clark Kissinger.
Thank you, Michael, and I want to thank also the Brecht Forum for hosting this event this evening, because I think it's very important that we dig into these incredibly significant transformations that are taking place in the country right now. Michael went through a lot of the changes that are taking place. There's actually books coming out on it now. Maybe you've seen this latest one called Takeover by Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe. People are writing books describing the phenomenon that's going on, but the sort of the thing that I wanted to dig into was going beyond the phenomenon to asking, well, why is this happening? What are the underlying forces at work here? Because I feel that this is taking place not because of ideas that have come out of the beady little minds of people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Addington, but rather these things are actually flowing out of the interplay of both freedoms and necessities for U.S. imperialist capitalism. And so taking a look at that, I think, gives us a little bit of an understanding of both why this is happening and also why, as Michael alluded to, it's not going to go backwards. You know, we're not going to be able to run the camera in reverse, as it were. One of the most interesting things to look at is, I think, these fundamental necessities that are faced by capitalism on a global scale. I mean, the most fundamental one, of course, is to make profits. Capitalism has to expand. It has to do that by making profits on the capital that's invested. But then that process gets mediated by a number of phenomena in the world, both contingencies as well as other necessities that that come to play in this situation. Just to take a look at an example of that that Michael alluded to, after World War II, there was an enormous growth of U.S. capitalism, but it was set in motion by the whole reconfiguring of the world as a result of World War II, in which the United States took over the colonies and spheres of influence not only of its not only of the defeated Axis, but also of its allies, Britain, France, and the Netherlands, and it put into motion a whole cycle of capital accumulation that went well into the 1970s. But then, when that began to collapse, the United States found itself hemmed in and stopped by the competition of a competing global power, which at that time was the Soviet Union, which I would argue actually had effectively reestablished capitalism in the sense that living labor was subordinated to the accumulation of value in that society, and that was the driving factor of it, regardless of what forms it juridically took. But when that happened, the United States was in a whole new matrix of power relations. But then, again, as Michael pointed out, the collapse of the Soviet Union suddenly broke that matrix apart and freed up a whole new situation in which the United States found itself in a position where it could make literally a move on the world. And this is what they went for. And the people who were involved in the Cheney, he was our Minister of Defense at that time, under the first Bush administration, actually drew up a plan for going about this on a global scale. And they were very unhappy. Clinton administration came in and didn't always follow exactly what their plan was. But what happened in this new situation to the matrix of freedoms and necessities is that, on the one hand, there was a freedom that was given to the United States to move militarily on a global scale, but at the same time, this freed up former U.S. allies and subordinates and lesser members of the gang, which was Japan, Europe, China, to actually then begin to pursue their own imperialist interests, their own capitalist interests, in competition with the United States. Well, the Project for a New American Century began publishing these papers saying, you know, this is now America's really great opportunity. And they began to move on it. But one of the things that they did was they actually made an analysis that where things had to go revolved around the Middle East. And the reason for that is that these newly freed up competing powers in Europe and in China, India, and Russia still, were basically dependent on fossil fuel reserves, which are overwhelmingly concentrated in the Persian Gulf and the Caspian Sea Basin. In other words, when the United States made a move on this area, this was not to make money for individual oil companies, you know. I mean, look, we don't have police in order to subsidize the blue cloth industry. What was going on here was actually a global power move in terms of the overall power relations. China right now is dependent on Iran for oil. It's a major importer of oil. And so control of this region is, in a certain sense, put stranglehold on competing powers on the whole Eurasian continent. The forces who were unhappy with not having this plan fully realized in the 1990s basically seized the presidency after the 2000 elections. They just stopped the vote count and they assumed power. And the only thing that was missing at that point was the pretext or the Pearl Harbor, and we got that, you know, in 9/11 and set it all in motion. This is interesting because, you know, people say, well, why did they attack Iraq? Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11. Well, of course it didn't, you know. I mean, the plan was to go after a series of countries to restructure the Middle East, as they constantly say. We're out there to restructure the Middle East. We want to move out of the existing feudal relations. We want to have nice bourgeois democratic neo-colonies. We want to reprivatize what had been nationalized oil, you know, in all of these areas. And it was a move on the entire region, you know, and that's he listed it, right? The axis of evil. Who are the axis of evil? These are the people we got a contract out on. And they began to move in that way. So the war on terror, so-called, and sold to this people as, you know, protecting America, you know, from crazy people around the world, was really a war for empire. But see, war for empire has incredible consequences domestically and in the science in the society in which we live. And this reorganization of the Middle East to, as they say, they literally say they want to clear the swamps. They want to clean out the swamps. One of the terms they use, and what they're referring to is the opposition that has been organized around Islamic fundamentalism in this area. But at the same time, I think it's important to understand that when this happens, that the world becomes presented more and more and more with a very ugly choice between U.S. imperialism and between the local feudal and comprador capitalists in these countries who are using Islamic fundamentalism as a way to whip up people, you know, against the United States and its allies. And both of these forces in the world represent historically outmoded modes of production and social life that would set the world back, you know, centuries if we had to go on under the rule of either one of them. And the problem is that they feed off of each one. Each one uses the other as the excuse for what it's doing and all this. So what becomes very important is for us to find a way to break out of that. The interesting thing, and it's created one author wrote a book about it, you know, said that the world today is sort of characterized by Mick World versus jihad, you know, U.S. imperialism versus these other, sometimes feudal forces even, who are resisting U.S. imperialism, but not for any reasons that would liberate the people within their countries. Essay I would refer you to on this, which I thought it was, well, I drew a lot from, was an essay called Bringing Forward Another Way by Bob Avakian, who goes kind of penetratingly into what that dynamic is between those two reactionary forces and why the people of the world need another way. And this also gives us the background of why there's a real danger of war on Iran, or if not war, some attempt to have a regime change, you know, within there, because this is, again, a part of the overall. It's not because Iran is somehow sneaking weapons into Iraq and killing U.S. service people. It has nothing to do with it, whether they're doing that or not, you know. It has to do with the fact that Iran is on the U.S. hit list for the overall. They're part of the axis of evil. How did this movement that got going globally, flowing out of both the necessities and the opportunities that came to capitalism, how did it reflect itself domestically? I think that's kind of the interesting thing for us. You know, the Bush regime is an interesting coalition. It's a coalition of these people that are called neocons, neoconservatives. It's a certain grouping of intellectuals who actually look back to pre-Enlightenment sources, literally. I mean, you know, to Greece and Rome, you know, for their ideas of governance, together with a movement that really can only be called Christian fascist. It's this movement of the mega churches. Actually, the Onion has a funny story this week saying mega churches threatened by ultra churches. But that provided a social base, you know, for all of this. And then tied into it is Christian Zionism. All of these different aspects went into it, all of which somehow revolved around the need for the United States to remake the Middle East. But to do that, they had to come up with a social situation, because they were in the process, and this started under Clinton, by the way, not under them, of taking apart the New Deal social contract. Manufacturing jobs, of course, were gone with the globalization that whose possibility came about because of the whole changed international situation, and then their need to impose sacrifice on the people of the United States. That's a very volatile situation. When you've got people who are literally trying to enforce biblical law, these people are theocrats. And they're all through the U.S. government right now, and they're heavy up in the military also. These people are theocrats. I went to one of these big conferences that they had, and they were complaining about the Supreme Court. And you think, well, they're probably going to complain about abortion or something like that. No, that's not what they complained about. They complained about the original, what was the original, what was the case where the Supreme Court got the power to overturn constitutional?
Marbury versus Madison.
They were complaining about Marbury versus Madison. This is amazing, right? This is like from 1803 or something like that.
1803.
Yeah, 1803. I mean, this is how deep these people's desire to uproot what exists right now is in this country. And so then you have, in addition to this police state measures, you have this mobilization against the Islamic menace that's going on. And it extends into a general anti-immigrant, a whole anti-immigrant atmosphere in the country, which Roberto is going to be talking to us about in a moment. And the heightened white supremacy that has become a part of this whole thing, the desire to recapture the white Christian character of the state in this country is a part of the building the social basis for this move on the world. And the open promotion of religion and attacks on science. You know, it's an imperialist wartime ethos. And the Bush regime basically just took the initiative. They just took the initiative and they began to put it into business. Well, as you may have noticed, it didn't all turn out well in terms of their war on Afghanistan and their war on Iraq and what they would like to do in Iran. But it's important to understand, and I think, again, Michael alluded to this, if people have this illusion that this pendulum is going to swing back the other way, or people have a desire to somehow come under the protection of some section of the ruling class that will somehow come to our aid and stop this and turn it around. And I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen, not because the Democrats don't have backbone. They've got enough backbone to go up against their whole constituency. But in the first place is they are in general agreement with the program of the Bush administration. They have tactical differences with it. They think he screwed up aspects of the war. But in terms of the idea that the United States must control and remake the Middle East and maintain control over the fossil fuel reserves of the world, they're in complete agreement with that. And they also agree that it would be an unmitigated disaster for U.S. imperialism if the United States were now defeated and forced out of Iraq. So of course they're not going to... That's why you can't get a single one of these people to pin down when would you actually, of the leading candidates, when would you actually get out of Iraq? And the other reason, though, is that nobody of these people has a coherent alternative to the Bush program. And the Bush program is just go in there and kick butt, you know, and take over countries and do what you want. And none of these Democrats who want to present themselves as an alternative management team for the ruling class have a coherent alternative to how to go about protecting U.S. imperial interests in the world that's that much different from what Bush is doing. So of course they're not resisting him. Of course they're not resisting him. But that's what we have to be able to see through. They have a see through in two ways. They have a necessity to see it through. They've got a tiger, but they've embarked on a very dangerous, high-stakes gamble, and they have to see it through. And this is in part why you see these whole police state measures being put in. And it's why we see no major Democratic candidate in the U.S. calling for denouncing the illegal seizures of executive power. We don't see a single one of these major Democratic candidates getting up and saying, we have to put an end to torture. You know, you're not going to see that in the debates. Or we have to repudiate nuclear threats against Iran. Or we have to disband the concentration camps. Or we have to end the illegal wiretaps. Or any of these other great crimes that are being committed. Why? Because they're in favor of them, and they are presenting themselves principally as an alternative management team for carrying them out more effectively. As a ruling class party, one other thing they're not about to do is the only thing that can stop this is millions of people in motion in the streets and taking on thing in a massive way and shutting the society down to, you know, doing what has to be done in order to bring this to a halt. And I'll tell you this, as a ruling class party, the Democrats are never, ever going to call the masses of people into the street in opposition to this stuff. So Bush continues to hold the initiative. War in Iran's a real possibility. The Dems are paralyzed because they have no alternative. On the other hand, their electoral constituency is totally at odds. And this is in part demobilizes them, too, because people who look to the Democratic Party and keep hoping and hoping and hoping it might do something become themselves demoralized. And the more you try and make the Democratic Party and hope that it will be what you want it to be, the more you're going to end up being what it actually is. So we see a country today in which there's a massive assault on the rule of law, in which secular government and separation of church and state are under attack. But this, in turn, has these contradictory effects. It's a source of great exposure. That's absolutely true. When you suddenly lay it all out, look at what these people are doing. But it still remains a source of great illusions. I think it's too often that rather than looking to these material freedoms and necessities that U.S. imperialism is responding to, you do get this idea that democracy is somehow a self-correcting mechanism, that the pendulum will swing back. Well, you know what happens? When the pendulum swings back, which it sometimes does, the fulcrum on which it's swinging has already moved so far to the right that when it swings back to the left, it's further right than it was when it was swinging to the right. And what was like yesterday's outrage becomes today's reluctant compromise and tomorrow's accepted new status quo that we should accept. This is a deadly logic that we have to break out of. Now, we have to break out of this. So there is not any going back to some idealized bourgeois democracy at this point. The idealized bourgeois democracy was in the first place a class dictatorship, even when it provided different constitutional procedures, and we should have no illusions about that. In fact, we should not at this point fear things going to extremes, because in reality, if things don't go to extremes, they can't get resolved in any kind of progressive ways. And the horrors that the people of the world are experiencing now are only going to get worse. The polarization in society today is between mainstream imperialism, which is kind of on the defensive, and the neocon Christian fascist grouping, which basically has the initiative. This is not the polarization that we need in society. We need to be fighting to repolarize society with all the defenders of imperialism on the defensive and those who want a whole new way having the off being on the initiative. And critical to that is fighting against every attack that comes down on the rights of the people, which is one of the things that we are here tonight to commend CCR for doing, and Vince Warren is going to be just describing that to us. And bringing into political life millions of people who no longer accept the crimes of this system in return for an illusory promise of relative comfort and safety. That is, living on the spoils of parasitism. Another world is possible, and we have to be challenging and inspiring people to go there.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.